watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Happy New Year and welcome back to local listeners on WEOS and ICR. You missed a couple of shows, but you can download them at the archive at unwelcomeguests.org. The good news is that we all waited for you to hear the next installment of the readings from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto, which resumes this week. And welcome to listeners of WUOW Oneonta, New York. Congratulations on your new station. I saved a very special talk to play for you this week, now that you're all here, that I think exemplifies the purpose of this show. This is actually the 340th episode of the show, and I don't think I've ever articulated what it is trying to accomplish. I'll let George Carlin explain. Excuse the blank spaces. I'm sure you can fill them in.
That's the big answer to everything. Education. They said we need more money for education. We need more books, more teachers, more classrooms, more schools. We need more testing for the kids. You say to them, well, you know, we've tried all of that, and the kids still can't pass the test. You say, oh, don't you worry about that. We're going to lower the passing grades. And that's what they do in a lot of these schools now. They lower the passing grades so more kids can pass. More kids pass, the school looks good, everybody's happy, the IQ of the country slips another 2 or 3 points, and pretty soon all you'll need to get into college is a f***ing pencil. Got a pencil? Get the f*** in there. It's physics. Then everyone wonders why 17 other countries graduate more scientists than we do. Education! Politicians know that word. They use it on you. Politicians have traditionally hidden behind three things. The flag, the Bible, and children. No child left behind. No child left behind. Oh, really? Well, it wasn't long ago you were talking about giving kids a head start. Head start? Left behind? Someone's losing f***ing ground here. But there's a reason. There's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The big, the wealthy, the real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're irrelevant. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media news, all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the... They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying... to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers, people who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your fucking retirement money. They want it back. so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. And by the way, it's the same big club they use to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged. And nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hard-working people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hard-working people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich suckers who don't give a f*** about them. They don't care about you at all. At all. At all. Yeah. You know? And nobody seems to notice, nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on, the fact that Americans will probably remain willfully ignorant of the big red, white, and blue that's being jammed up their asses every day. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it. You have to be asleep to believe it.
Good morning. Knowledge is power. This week, an in-depth analysis of the so-called war on terrorism, the latest version of something that began long before September 11th, 2001. The speaker is Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed at the Department of International Relations, University of Brighton, UK. He's author of several books, including The War on Truth, 9/11 Disinformation and the Anatomy of Terrorism, and Behind the War on Terror, Western Secret Strategy and the Struggle for Iraq. He spoke in London last November.
Assalamu alaikum. For those non-Muslims amongst us, that means peace be upon you, which is the staple Islamic greeting. It's good to be here. Thanks for coming along.
Phew.
Well, I guess you've all seen this. You might have seen this if you've come along. You might not. It's the advert that was put out for this. And really, this is kind of supposed to be a really broad overview of the dynamics of what's happening under the mantle of the war on terror. So it's going to be, I've got my new book on London bombings here for you to have a look at. And I've got a pile of books here, which are kind of like my exhibits, I guess. And I'm going to be brandishing them at you occasionally as I talk. So we're going to begin. The title was International Terrorism, The Secret History. And, well, I think let's begin with what's just happened recently. We had the Democrats taking control of Congress. And a lot of people have seen this as kind of like a very, very positive development. And I think to some extent it is. To some extent it's certainly a shift which... To a different form of government, or a sign of that kind of shift taking place. But this kind of sentiment that we're seeing in the news, that this is a really good thing, this means a drastic change in the way the United States is going to be doing things in terms of its foreign policy. This is really kind of linked to the fact that the war on terror is often perceived as a very new phenomenon that is linked to the Bush administration. In particular, so to link to the rise to power of the neoconservatives. And in particular, the war on terror is widely perceived to be manifest, particularly in the post-9/11 war on Iraq, and secondarily, perhaps, the war in Afghanistan. But the focus really is very much on the war in Iraq. And as a result of that, the anti-war movement tends to focus on the Iraq issue as really the kind of be-all and end-all of its activities. So it tends to revolve around calling for the withdrawal of US and UK forces from Iraq. Now, I'm going to try and make this slightly more interactive. I'm not just going to bang on at you, because that tends to make people fall asleep, including me. So my first question for you is, I mean, who thinks that the Democrat vote will result in some kind of change? And if so, what kind of change do you think it will result in?
Not enough.
Very superficial. Make it slightly easier for Americans like me. But, I mean, just on a superficial level.
Yeah.
It's the people pulling strings.
Yeah.
Or be the same.
Yeah.
So no policy change at all. It might be detrimental because it might be lulling people into a false sense of security.
Yeah.
Or yeah. Maybe they'll think that they've done with it.
Yeah. That's the concern that I have as well, actually. And I mean, here in the UK, obviously, there's a very similar kind of phenomenon, which is to link Iraq, British militarism to New Labour and to Blair. And so there is this campaign to kind of topple Blair and to get rid of New Labour. But it doesn't really kind of recognise that getting rid of New Labour is not necessarily the solution. Because this is really because there is a misdiagnosis of the problem, of the illness, I guess, if you want to use medical terminology. So my take, and the take that many of you will probably agree with, is that this is based on a very serious and entrenched misreading of the dynamic of US policy, and not just US policy, British policy and Western policy, which in fact is driven not by particular cliques, you know, a particular clique or faction, but is driven by core geostrategic and economic interests, which are related to an interlocking centres of military and corporate power. And these centres of power and the way they interact, that is really what drives policy. And if you have that perspective, then the truth is that the war on terror is not something new at all. In fact, it's a continuation and extension of Anglo-American imperialism in the post-Cold War period, designed to protect and perpetuate a very specific form of system. What we can call, for the moment, we can call it the global imperial system. And so if you want to understand what's actually happening today, we need to understand what we mean by the global imperial system. And if we wanted to do that in real depth, we could go all the way back to Columbus in 1492, but I don't want to do that because we'll be here for years and it won't really be very conducive. There's a lot of stuff to cover. So for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to focus on this kind of new period of history signified by the end of the Second World War. And as this is going to be a bit of a history, a lot of it's going to be historical. I'm not going to be focusing on 9/11 and 7/7 hugely in my talk. I think that will become clear as we talk. But there'll be ample time to discuss those issues in more detail in the Q&A session at the end. But let's begin with the state of the world after the Second World War. We had a situation where we just had the Second World War. Europe was devastated. We had a Stalinist Russia on the one side, which is fairly weak as well after the Second World War. Wasn't really looking to do very much except recuperate. We then had the most powerful nation was the United States, and this really was, the United States even before the Second World War was a rising power. But the Second World War put the United States in a position of fundamental global preeminence. And this was because they basically emerged very particularly unscathed. They had the advantage of a large landmass, huge resources, a vibrant economy, and a very, very strong military. And compared to everybody else, there was no parallel. So for the first time, the Second World War kind of opened the way for a very single hegemon. And that hadn't existed before, clearly. And I think in the world, if you look at world history, I don't think there's ever been a single global hegemon emerging in sight. And it's interesting to look at, because I'm going to throw a couple of documents at you as we go along. And there's one set of documents that was being produced by US policy planners who were with the State Department. And that what they had done, they'd set up these working groups before the end of the Second World War, because they were already planning what would happen if there was a victory. And they set up these working groups with the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, which, as most of you will know, is a very influential think tank. And these working groups, basically, they had experts, policy experts, planning how to reconstruct world order after the Second World War. What were the objectives? And there is a book by a guy, there's two professors in the United States called Lawrence Shoup and William Minter, The book is called Imperial Brain Trust, and the subtitle is The Council on Foreign Relations and US Foreign Policy. It's actually out of print, but you can get it on print on demand. And it's a very, very insightful book. And the authors draw on this wealth of policy documents that came out at that time. And what the planners identified what they described as a minimum world area, which comprised the entire Western Hemisphere, the former British Empire, and the Far East. And what they said was that, what these documents said was that economic control over these areas was, quote, essential for the security and economic prosperity of the United States and the entire Western Hemisphere. And what they said was that the only way that we can get this control is if we secure the limitation of any exercise of sovereignty by foreign nations that constitute a threat to this world area. And that's an interesting point, because imperialism, academically, is defined by the ability of one configuration of power, particularly the idea of a sovereign power, to actually influence the decisions of another sovereign power from outside. So this is a clearly kind of statement of imperial intent, the idea that they want to control what other sovereign states are doing in relation to this lucrative area. And what they said was that to achieve that, it's required the United States needs to have an integrated policy to achieve military and economic supremacy. And then they went on, they argued that on this basis, the concept of security interests should be extended to include the domination of these regions strategically necessary for world control. So this was a pretty candid set of papers. I mean, openly saying that we're talking about world control, we're talking about economic control, we're talking about military and economic supremacy. So you probably wouldn't find a clearer statement of imperial intent at the dawn of this new era of international relations. So then there is a question mark over, so what was Britain doing at that time? Britain had its own empire, which was obviously on the decline by the middle of the 20th century. And while US policymakers were planning their own things, the British were also looking around and thinking, okay, well, you know, we've got a bit of a problem here. We've got our empire kind of unravelling. What are we going to do? And there was an interesting British top secret treasury document from 1950. So this is by the end of the Second World War. And it said, any general withdrawal by the United Kingdom on the political and military fronts would have an adverse effect on our economic position. So they were very worried about the implications of decolonization. Decolonization was the rollback of formal colonial control. So this was considered a serious problem. Indeed, it was on the basis of that that the British very carefully planned how they would administer the process of decolonization in order that they wouldn't fundamentally damage their access to the same resources that they already had in the era of formal control. There was a study by a guy called Cranford Pratt, who's a professor emeritus at University of Toronto. He's a historian. And he did a study of Africa and the decolonization of Africa under the Brits. And what he said was that all that the British planners who drew up the plans for decolonization advocated can be interpreted as, quote, shrewdly designed to protect and advance British economic and political interests in these changing circumstances. And he went on, the professor went on, he said, underlying decolonization, there was a plan to convert or reconvert formal into informal empire as the need arose. And this isn't actually, a lot of people think this might be, maybe there's a fringe area of history where some historians say this, but actually there's some very prominent historians who admit this. There's one guy from Oxford University, D.K. Fieldhouse, who is a professor in imperial history. He's a very well known, he's like a leader in his field. And he also says that the continuity of economic dependence of the colonies was the intended result of decolonialism. And I could go on bringing forth similar kinds of quotes from people who've studied the history on this. So how did they reconcile this? Well, there were two things. One of the things that is clear from the documents is that the Brits knew that their empire was in decline. So they knew they needed to have some way, some mechanism to keep some kind of control, but they knew that there was an unraveling that was inevitable. On the other hand, the United States knew that they were in a preeminent position, but at the same time, they were looking at the areas that used to be under the control of the Brits. And they were saying, well, you know, if we want to maintain our supremacy, we need to get control of those areas. And at that particular time, even though the British were facing a lot of problems, it was the Brits who had control over these areas. So the logical solution was a compromise. And the compromise was very simple. Britain would join the United States as kind of like a junior strategic partner under an American-dominated framework. And there is actually one document from the Foreign Office which says that. It actually says that the United States accepted the UK, thanks, as, quote, junior partner in an orbit of power predominantly under the American aegis. And that's very, very important, because you get some people who kind of wonder about this special relationship between Bush and Blair, and Blair being Bush's poodle. And some people think this is a new thing, but it's not a new thing. This is something which was actually agreed formally at the beginning of the construction of this particular world order. That's hugely significant to understand the way the British and the American policies work. So we have this now, we have this new era of Anglo-American power. The United States on top, Britain in a kind of secondary level. So the question then was, how would they run this new order that they were planning on doing? And again, the documents are very, very revealing. There's documents from the Foreign Office which are particularly insightful. Again, the British Treasury said in 1945, it said that we have to devise techniques for bringing influence to bear on other countries' internal decisions, especially those related to development. So again, the shift of policy was very important, because before that, policy was oriented, it was very formal, it was about controlling governments, maintaining troops in certain regions, and so on and so forth. But now it was changed. No, it was like, how do we, from outside, maintain influence on what's happening inside a country? And interestingly, it says very explicitly, how do we maintain control over another country's internal decisions? So look at the shift. It's not anymore that we have a British Empire which is now going to decide for you. It's no, you've got your own decisions. But how do we influence those decisions? So that's where the sphere of imperialism changes. And interestingly, one of the key issues is development. So there's an economic component there. And the document continues. It says, we should be able to exert a very great influence on the structure of that development. We could usefully begin with parts of the world in which we already have a great influence, the colonial empire, the Middle East and India. But there were other methods as well that were mentioned. Another document says it's important to maintain in friendly hands areas which contain or protect sources of metals, oils and other national resources, which contain strategic objectives or areas strategically located which contain a substantial industrial potential, blah, 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 it goes on and on. So again, there's another method here, which is maintaining a particular area that is considered to be of interest to you in friendly hands. So in other words, it's all about how to maintain dominance without doing it directly, using surrogates, influencing the decisions of those surrogates, and so on and so forth. Now, how did this play out on a worldwide scale? Again, this is a very, very important thing to understand. Quite consciously, the United States, Western Europe and Britain consciously looked at the globe and they made a decision on how they would organise and administer the world. And the United States, so they actually looked at the key areas. They looked at Asia, they looked at the Middle East, and they looked at Africa. And they said, okay, we don't want to fight over this because we've just emerged out of the Second World War and we've had enough fighting. Let's do this the nice way. And in some extent, really, it was really a case of the United States and Britain, to some extent, had a much more powerful say, because Western Europe at that time was completely devastated. So looking at Africa, for example, the United States advocated, quote, arrangements whereby a union of Western European nations would undertake jointly the economic development and exploitation of the colonial and dependent areas of Africa. And then there was another document about Asia, Southeast and South Asia, which says that the exploitation of these areas should contribute not only to the welfare of Asia, but also to the balance of world trade by developing sources of raw material for the United States and Europe. And finally, the Middle East. US planners in 1945, there is a document from the State Department which says, our petroleum policy towards the UK is predicated on a mutual recognition of a very extensive joint interest and upon control, at least for the moment, of the very great bulk of the free petroleum resources of the world. And it goes on to talk about a very special joint US-UK relationship on controlling Middle East oil. So that is basically the bulk of it. To some extent, Africa, at that particular time, was considered to be useful, but they gave joint access to Western Europe, and also to some extent to Asia. But Asia had kind of basically was dominated by the United States and Britain. But in the Middle East in particular, the United States wanted to ensure that it and Britain had a almost exclusive monopoly on access in the Middle East. And the historical record actually bears that out, and to some extent explains even what's happening now. So then, obviously, the question is then, how does that relate to what happened afterwards with the Cold War? So I have another question for you that I prepared, which was one of the key doctrines that is used to explain the Cold War is containment theory. And containment theory basically says the idea that the Soviet Union was considered a real serious threat that was prepared to invade the United States. Sorry, not the United States. Well, to some extent, there were people who thought the USSR was ready to invade the United States as well. But generally, the idea was that they were ready to invade Western Europe. They're right on the border. And obviously, they were planning to expand communism internationally and basically establish a world empire. What I want to ask you is, do you think that the containment theory is accurate? And what do you think the Cold War was really about?
Just a cover up for each of these so-called superpowers going and doing their bit, exploiting every part of the world that they could lay their hands on, reach, or manipulate. And this was just to fool the rest of the world.
Wow, we have some cynical people in the audience today. Anyone, what do we think of that? Isn't that true?
I think basically, it's a fairly cozy relationship between two people who've kind of agreed to their different turfs. And the threat of the other keeps people within each one more or less in line.
Yeah.
Sort of like the mafioso.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You control that street, we'll have this street, and we won't fight each other.
You raised your guard that you
raised. I'm Paul Scott, just to introduce myself from the Nelson Mandela magazine. I think they're rival imperialist camps. Soviets wanted to expand, or at the very least to hold what they had. As you saw in countries like Hungary, they turned nasty when people didn't want that.
Yeah.
And equally the Americans, particularly in Latin America, looked to expand their influence and to, as we've seen with the bullying of Cuba or Venezuela, they look to hold what they have and gain more and more when they can.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this really does, the cynicism, the extreme cynicism is basically justified by the historical record. This always tends to be the case, I think, in history.
Sorry, that, do you mean by extreme cynicism that the Soviet Union was not a threat equal to the threat of America and Britain as you portray it?
Well, let's. I'll give you my explanation of, I mean, I think I agree with the idea that the Cold War was really a case of there was a bipolar system where each power was using the threat of the other, or the alleged, or the projected threat of the other, as a way of mobilizing its own populations, which were often for quite different interests. Often what they were mobilizing for was not actually about defending against this threat, but about things, quite different things. And I'm not going to talk about the USSR very much, because my interest...
No, but the truth is that the Cold War, if it had two sides, on one side, let's say, the West, and on the other side, the USSR, the imperialistic approach, desire, plans of USSR at that time were no less than that of the West. In other words, USSR left by itself would indeed have invaded the rest of Europe, no less the rest of Asia.
I have to disagree with that very strongly. If you actually study the Stalin's foreign policy in the Russian at the period of Russia, I mean, now we know. Now the documents have come out from both the State Department and even from the old Soviet files. And they all pretty much make clear that Stalin was not interested in exporting communism.
You are taking the documents coming from under the regime of Stalin to be a non-biased, objective record of what Stalin wanted. I'm sorry, I wouldn't be the only person, but the majority of people who specialise on those documents would disagree with you.
That's not true.
It is true.
No.
They are not considered a primary, non-biased historical documents.
The documents that have come out from Stalin's files, there are eternal documents. There are some documents which were used for propaganda. There are others which are internal documents that were used only for access despite by Stalin and his closest aides. And those documents give a great deal of insight into what Stalin was thinking. And it's pretty much, there's a consensus in the study of Stalin, at least, that Stalin was not interested in exporting communism. In fact, he was very annoyed when China came out on the scene because he didn't want to export Soviet communism to China.
No, he wanted to rule. He was not interested in exporting. He was interested to expand, to dominate, and to rule.
Can you give me a source that will justify that? Because, I mean, I've been...
The source is Eastern Europe.
Eastern European scholars don't agree with this idea.
What, that Stalin was not interested in ruling Eastern Europe? As part of its empire.
He made a very, very concerted effort to consolidate Soviet control over Eastern Europe. But that's a very different thing to saying that he wanted to take over the world. Let's look at what the United States had to say about the Soviet threat. I mean, there's a lot of documents that have come out from the United States and from the British Foreign Office files which show what our own policy planners were thinking. And a lot of what we were saying to the public at that time contradicts very much what politicians were actually saying behind the scenes. This is very interesting because one of the documents about the Soviet threat is, the canonical document was NSC 68, National Security Council Directive. And NSC 68 was basically the kind of landmark directive which outlined the contours of the Soviet threat. And was the first document really to put it all down in paper and to say this is what we need to do and why. And there's a very interesting section in that document. I have no doubt the Soviet Union was a threat. I don't agree with that at all. Not at all.
You haven't obviously lived under the yoke of the Soviet Union.
No, I mean, you can see my age. I haven't.
Exactly.
You know. But, anyway, there's a section from NSC 68 which is worth quoting. It says, "Our overall policy at the present time may be described as one designed to foster a world environment in which the American system can survive and flourish. This broad intention embraces two subsidiary positions." And this is the one I'm focusing on. One is a policy which we would probably pursue even if there was no Soviet threat. That was the first indication from within the document itself that the actual policy being outlined was not necessarily linked to the reality of a threat. So, disregarding whether there was a threat or not a threat, the document showed that perhaps the threat was actually something considered to be useful for justifying a policy that would have existed anyway. And in fact, this is kind of borne out by the way communism was described at the time. We have one guy, Richard Barnett, who used to work in the State Department. Can't remember his actual position. I did have it in my notes, but I don't have it here. But he actually said that the containment doctrine provided a very useful framework for demonizing threats not to national security, but rather to economic interests. And this is what he said. He said, even the word communist has been applied so liberally and so loosely to revolutionary or radical regimes that any government risks being characterized as communist if it adopts one or more of the following policies which the State Department finds distasteful. He said, one, nationalization of private industry. Two, particularly foreign-owned corporations. Three, radical land reform. Four, autarkic trade policies or independent trade policies. Five, acceptance of Soviet or Chinese aid. Six, insistence upon following an anti-American or non-aligned foreign policy. And then seven is others, other issues, miscellaneous issues. And interestingly, the guy who designed, and he was the guy who actually created the containment doctrine, George Kennan, who was chief of the policy planning unit in the State Department around this period, 1950s, he actually argued in the 70s, I think it was, I'm not sure, it's in my notes somewhere, in the 70s or 80s, he actually admitted that, quote, the image of a Stalinist Russia poised and yearning to attack the West and deterred only by possession of atomic weapons was largely a creation of Western imagination. This is from the man who actually designed the containment doctrine. And since I wasn't going to focus very much on this issue, but since it came up, I'll give you the documents that I've come across from the British Foreign Office files, and some of these are available, books by this guy, Mark Curtis, who is a British historian. He used to work at the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And his first book is really his best book. I don't have it with me. It's called The Ambiguities of Power. It was published in 1995. It's the most comprehensive book on British foreign policy. I can strongly recommend it. But these are his other ones. And he's got another one out as well.
Unpeople,
yeah, which is not bad. And a lot of these documents that I'm quoting, you can find there. And I've picked them up from bits and pieces, including from Mark's work. And including the following, there's a couple of documents here that Mark has quoted. And these are all Foreign Office files. One of them is about he went through every single region, major region, and he assessed what was the Foreign Office analysis at that time, in the internal Foreign Office analysis of the threat level. And what he found was that it was systematically contradicting the public line, which was that there was an imminent threat of an imminent reality of actual interference, subversion, communist penetration, and so on and so forth. So in the Middle East, for example, there's a Foreign Office paper in 1950 which said only three Middle Eastern countries are exposed to direct Soviet attack. And then it went on to illustrate that such an attack was basically inconceivable in all three cases for strategic reasons. Then it said, short of general war, an attack on Turkey is unlikely, owing to the Western guarantees which she enjoys, blah, blah, blah. As for Iran, the Soviet government must be aware that any attack on her would carry a grave risk of general war, and it's more likely that Soviet efforts will be confined to propaganda, diplomatic activity, and subversive activity. But there is no threat of invasion. Regarding Afghanistan, it said there's little danger of attack. Another document on the Middle East said, well, basically that Arab states are mostly oriented towards the West in varying degrees, opposed to communism, and generally successful in minimizing or suppressing communist activity. But it said that the real threat is from ultra-nationalist elements that may exercise greater influence and form a greater threat to maintenance of a pro-Western orientation. And this is interesting because ultra-nationalism consistently surfaces in the declassified planning record as the real issue, not communism. Communism is often there, but nationalism is obviously is another issue which keeps coming up. So, for example, in Africa, around the same period, the State Department observed that, quote, black Africa is orientated towards the non-communist world. Communism has made no real progress in this area. To the contrary, nationalism constitutes the real force of the future in this area, blah, blah, blah. And basically the documents go on like that. I mean, even in Asia, there's George Kennan at that time, while he was head of the US policy planning staff, said the problem is not one primarily of Russians, but of basic relations of Americans with Asiatics. And it carries on like that. Now, I think those documents would be consistent with both my perspective and your perspective, even if you hold the view that there was an actual intent on the part of the Soviet Union to expand and to take over the world. The documents would show that they had failed dismally and there was very little chance it was actually going to happen. So, to some extent, the reality of it, of what the Soviet Unions were intending, is not very important. It's obviously historically important, but it's not necessarily essential to understand what we were thinking at that time. And clearly, the declassified record shows that communism was not the primary mobilizing factor for the formulation of policy in these regions. And in fact, this is what Mark Curtis's argument is. His argument is that really, consistently, British and American foreign policy during the Cold War was about crushing nationalist movements for self-determination. And this is where we get to the interesting part.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go on.
What's the situation about the conflict in the Americas in Vietnam and North Korea in terms of foreign policy?
Well, North and South Korea was clearly, there's evidence that the Soviet Union was consulted by the North Koreans. North Koreans went to them and spoke to them before they decided to invade South Korea. So there is some nominal evidence of a Soviet connection, but it's not clear precisely what precipitated what. The same is really, I think with Vietnam, it's slightly more clearer. Vietnam, it's very much established that the Soviet Union only got involved in Vietnam after the United States got involved. And that's simply a matter of looking at the date. It's very well known that the input of arms from the Soviet Union escalated after the United States was involved. And in fact, even if you look at that period, the amount of weaponry that was coming in, if you compare how much was coming in from the Soviet Union and China, compare it to how much was coming in from the Americans. The Americans were something like 10 times the amount that was coming in from that communist bloc. So if you want to understand the dynamics of what was happening in Vietnam, you have to look inside Vietnam and understand what was happening, what was it that was mobilizing Vietnamese population and motivating them? And what was it about that configuration that worried the Americans? I mean, again, I recommend Mark Curtis's book because he discusses this from a British perspective and looks at what the British were doing. And in fact, the British had a very, very interesting role in Vietnam. But we'll leave that for another time. So moving on to explain precisely what happened during the Cold War, there was a very secretive issue which is called Gladio. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Gladio. Does anyone know anything about Gladio?
Is it something to do with European groups and Western?
Yeah, stay behind. Gladio is very, very interesting and crucial. It's a very, very understudied area of history.
Gladio is also a weapon that Roman is the sword.
Well, you're Italian. You should know about Gladio. Yeah. Gladio, well, Gladio is linked very much to Italy, but it's not just about Italy. There is a book that I have here called NATO Secret Armies. The guy, he's a Swiss guy, Daniel Ganzer. This is an academic book. This is published by Frank Cass, which is a London-based academic publisher. He's also published about this issue in various peer-reviewed journals, and the newest edition is published by Routledge. Again, it's a very esteemed academic publisher. This is very, very well documented material. And basically, this is the phenomenon that Daniel Ganzer brings to light. He's not the first one to have talked about this, but he's the first one to have done a systematic, comprehensive study. And he says that during the Cold War, the United States, the UK, and Western European governments and secret services, they participated in a very sophisticated, very secretive NATO-backed operation that was designed to engineer domestic terrorist attacks to be blamed on the Soviet Union within Western Europe. And basically, Ganser, he works at the Center for Security Studies at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. And basically, his book is based mostly on official sources, and those include, like, there are a couple of parliamentary inquiries in Europe into this phenomenon. So he looks at the transcripts of those inquiries. He also looks at, there's a very few secret documents that have been released, because governments have been very, very, they've put a clamp down on these documents. But he looks at those. He also interviews various officials, government and intelligence officials, who are involved, and he knew about this operation. And the whole thing, basically, was actually hatched by, it wasn't hatched by the Americans, it was hatched by Prime Minister Winston Churchill in July 1940. He called for the establishment of a secret army to, quote, set Europe ablaze by assisting resistance movements and carrying out subversive operations in enemy-held territory. And the idea at the time was, well, what we want to do is, if there is a possibility that the Soviet Union overruns any of these Western European countries, we have these secret networks, these secret soldiers that are capable of moving into action and carrying out kind of like guerrilla warfare. That was actually the original kind of idea. But in time, it became something quite different, something quite sinister. Now, by October 1945, the British Chiefs of Staff and the Special Operations Branch of MI6, they basically directed the creation of this skeleton network that was capable of expansion either in war or to provide support to secret operations abroad. And then within the ensuing years, the United States got much more closely involved. And MI6 began cooperating very closely with the CIA, and specifically with a department of the CIA called the Office of Policy Coordination. And this was organized right from the top of the White House. And what they did, they basically set up these very secretive secret armies across Western Europe. And there's one document that Ganser brings to light. This was a classified document. I'm going to read the whole thing out to you. It was authored by the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency. It's a field manual. It's actually a field manual that was given to these soldiers to train them. And this is what the manual says. It says, there may be times when host country governments show passivity or indecision in the face of communist subversion, and according to the interpretation of the US Secret Services, do not react with sufficient effectiveness. US Army intelligence must have the means of launching special operations which will convince host country governments and public opinion of the reality of the insurgent danger. To reach this aim, US Army intelligence should seek to penetrate the insurgency by means of agents on special assignment with the task of forming special action groups among the most radical elements of the communist insurgency. In case this isn't possible, then what we should do is instrumentalize extreme leftist organizations for our own ends in order to achieve the above described targets. These operations should remain strictly secret. Only those persons acting against the uprisings shall know the involvement of the US Army, blah, blah, blah. Now, this document, the State Department officially says that this document is not authentic. They deny its authenticity. But the document was described as authentic and valid in its content by a man called Ray Klein, who was deputy director of the CIA under JFK. And he later became director of the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which was the agency which published this field manual. And basically what it does, it instructs these secret soldiers to carry out acts of violence in times of peace, in Ganser's words, in order to blame them on the communists to create a situation of fear and alertness. Alternatively, instructs them to infiltrate the left wing and urge them to use violence. And this is a very, very disturbing development. And in fact, this emerged into officialdom in 1990, in August, when the whole thing was basically blown open in Italy by the Prime Minister of that time, Giulio Andreotti, basically admitted that Gladio existed. And within Italy, it was called Operation Gladio. I don't know if it's got a name across Western Europe, but in Italy, it was called Gladio. And he said that basically Gladio had been was exposed as a secret subsection of the Italian military intelligence services, and it had been responsible for domestic bombings that had been blamed on Italian communists. And they had a whole parliamentary inquiry which investigated this. And in fact, the EU, the European Union, actually within 1 or 2 years actually gave a resolution. It's in this book at the beginning, on the whole phenomenon. And it was very disturbing. There was a lot of stuff in the press around that time. But basically, Italy was not the only country where this happened. Ganza documents that there were a wave of terrorist attacks blamed on the Soviet Union, not only in Italy, but also in Spain, in Germany, in France, Turkey, Greece, and elsewhere, which were, in fact, organised by these secret networks. So this leads us to a pretty unsavoury conclusion. It doesn't mean that many government officials didn't believe their own propaganda. Certainly many, many officials did. But what it does mean is that there were certainly, at certain high levels, there was a secret element within the Western intelligence community that was involved in deliberately inflating and embellishing the Soviet threat by literally any means possible. And this phenomenon, of course, raises very crucial questions about the role of international terrorism today. So the next section I want to talk about is, well, how do we theorise this and then apply that to our current state to learn something? And what I've done, I've divided it into three main points. And I've said that really what this means is that in the absence of a clear kind of mobilising factor to justify the militarisation of Western society at that particular time, military intelligence services, and not even just the CIA by itself, we're talking about very, very secretive subsections of intelligence services on the orders of a very small group of people within in a political level, basically took it upon themselves to manufacture, both ideologically and operationally, in other words, in reality, a projected external threat of monolithic proportions. And so there's three tiers to it. First of all, we have the basis there's a predominance of a very specific type of interest in the expansion and consolidation of an Anglo-American dominated world system. The second prerequisite is the lack of a viable Soviet threat sufficient to legitimize the militarization that is required to pursue those policies. The third tier then is that when you have the absence of that, there is an ideological and an operational attempt to construct by these intelligence services and policymakers to construct a projected external threat consisting of this international dimension. And to some extent, there is a danger that that construction is not just ideological, that it actually takes a physical form. And that is the most disturbing thing for me, from my perspective. So the question is really what happened after when we had the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990. By 1990 there was a collapse of the Soviet Union, clearly. So this entailed the collapse of, this three-tier structure then also collapsed, because then that self-reinforcing, mobilising factor wasn't there. So for the first time, this opened the way. Without a doubt, the Soviet Union's existence prevented the United States from doing everything it wanted to do. The whole area of the world was closed off to Anglo-American interest. So for the first time, when the Soviet Union collapsed, this opened the way for the United States to project military power, even economic power, in these key regions that previously they couldn't even have imagined that. So in other words, it was almost like it was a whole new ball game. The world was our oyster in a way. But there was another problem. So although there was this amazing new opportunity, at the same time, there was this question of, how do we sustain that forced projection? How do we justify it when the very entity that was preventing us from going there is now gone, because now we don't have a pretext, we don't have a justification? And it's in this context that Al-Qaeda plays a very crucial role. So my question to you at this point is, we hear a lot about Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's everywhere. Al-Qaeda does this, Al-Qaeda does that. Al-Qaeda is behind some things. But interestingly, Al-Qaeda wasn't behind the London bombings. But what I want to put to you is, what do you think Al-Qaeda is? Now, do you think it does exist? If it does exist, what is it? Or does it not exist? If it doesn't exist, then what's happening?
You're listening to Nafees Ahmed, author of The War on Truth. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica.us, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. We continue with Nafees Ahmed.
There's a question from you.
Yeah, well, according to Adam Curtis' program, Power of Nightmares, the first time Al-Qaeda came out was when the Americans were trying to convict the first bomber of the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And to convict them, they needed to prove a conspiracy, i.e. that he wasn't acting alone, because then they could use mafia laws to convict them. So they invented the network, Al-Qaeda, the base, to be the group that was part of the conspiracy that then allowed them to prosecute the guy's name, Robert Dock, for first bombing of Ramsey.
So,
according to this theory in particular, it was again something that was invented to provide a common enemy to Americans feel safe that we're here, and therefore there's somebody else.
For those of you who aren't familiar, there is the film is a BBC film called The Power of Nightmares, produced by this guy Adam Curtis. Does anyone else want to say anything?
Yeah, I was going to ask, I don't know if you like cricket, but I kind of like the analogy of the President's 11. If, you know, if England are going to play abroad, they have to have a big-up team to oppose, and in the sense, it seems like the Al-Qaeda or the Al-Qaeda myth or whatever reality is there is that it's all, that its main role is to have a focus for kind of external threat, so it's kind of a pickup team.
Well, to some extent there's been some very good points made, and I'm going to try and elaborate on that a little bit, because it's a fair point to raise the question about, does Al-Qaeda exist? Because I think the thing that Adam Curtis brought out very clearly was, and a number of other scholars have brought this out, that first of all, the actual usage of Al-Qaeda by the people who supposedly involved with Al-Qaeda wasn't there. It was, in fact, it was by, in the 1998 US embassy bombings, there was a witness on the stand, one of the conspirators, and it was like, are you a member of Al-Qaeda? And the guy was like, well, yes, I'm a member of that organization which you call Al-Qaeda. And in fact, Al-Qaeda had not been openly used by these people before that period of time. So the gentleman made a good point in that respect, and Adam Curtis raises that issue. So there's a question of, what is the existence of this group? And another journalist, Jason Burke, wrote a book called Al-Qaeda Casting a Shadow of Terror, where he says, he really raises questions about the organizational structure. I mean, if you go back a couple of years, the Brits and the Americans was describing Al-Qaeda as this monolithic, centralized, command and control, tentacles everywhere structure, you know, where you had one little guy there on the ground, on the phone to Bin Laden. It was kind of like a Marxist-Leninist, you know, these are the compadres of Bin Laden. It was a very, very kind of unsophisticated portrayal, and I think they've realised that, and they've moved away from that quite consciously, because it's been discredited in by subsequent research. So it's very clear that, I think if you study the phenomenon, that there isn't much evidence to say that there is this very clear structure, this very clear organisation. It's very difficult to say that.